Might as well start. So I'm Alan Perelson. I'm from the Theoretical Biology and Biophysics Group at Los Alamos. I've been here, this is my fourth time. I don't work on bacterial evolution. So let me give you a little bit of my background and then we'll get into this. So I have 2 degrees from MIT. I have 1 in biology and 1 in electrical engineering. And then I have a PhD from Berkeley in biophysics. I spent a year in a polymer department, and I spent time as a postdoc in a chemical engineering department. And I've done quite a lot of applied mathematics. So I sort of am around the whole spectrum. My early career was in modeling the immune system, and I've been to KITP on a number of occasions running immune system modeling workshops. So things, for those of you who heard earlier, that Alex Walchek and Cherry Moore are doing. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, when HIV became an enormous concern, I moved from working on modeling the immune system into modeling infectious disease. And ever since then, I've been involved in problems that I think can make a contribution to human health. So I did a lot of work starting then in HIV, and I'll show you one slide about that. I continue work on HIV, but then I've picked up by various collaborations work in a variety of other infectious diseases. And I'll tell you today about a story about HCV, hepatitis C virus. I work on hepatitis B virus, influenza, I've done some work on West Nile. We're working now on Zika virus and just published in PNAS a couple of weeks ago, sort of the first dynamic model of what goes on within a host with Zika, if anyone's interested in that. But let me tell you the hepatitis C story, because hepatitis C is not very well known to this group, at least the people I've spoken to. And it's interesting because it's the first chronic viral illness that we've been able to cure with drug therapy. So here's just a list of some of the chronic viral infections that you may know: HIV, Hep B, C, human papillomavirus, in which there's a vaccine for, Epstein-Barr, cytomegaloviruses, and people who are infected with these viruses just live with them for life, and there are others. HCV, within the last few years, we've actually been able to cure something like 95 to 97% of people who take the appropriate drug regime. But let me tell you about this virus. It's a positive sense RNA virus. Its genome is a little less than 10 kb. It's about 9.6 kb. It has an error-prone RNA-dependent polymerase. Because it's positive sense, it's basically a messenger RNA. So the virus enters a cell by binding to various cell surface receptors. It's got a very complicated entry process that's not fully understood, but somewhere between 4 and 7 proteins have been identified on cell surfaces that it interacts with when it enters a cell. It uncoats, releases this positive sense messenger RNA, gets translated in one single reading frame into a huge polyprotein, which then gets cleaved by a set of both host proteases and an enzyme-encoded protease called the HCV protease. That cleaves out this polymerase, which allows the RNA to replicate, and it replicates in some sort of machine called a replication complex that's built with a set of host proteins, a very complicated machine. The virus ultimately buds off the ER and is released from the cell along the secretory pathway. So that's sort of the life cycle of the virus. It's a health problem because it specifically infects the liver. It can lead to cirrhosis, which is basically a scarring of the liver. The immunopathology in hepatitis C is due to the immune system recognizing that cells are virally infected and coming in and trying to kill them. Host response, the body's response to that is to both have cells proliferate to make up for the ones that are killed, but it also, in terms of cytokine and other types of inflammation, gets into a wound healing type of response. And cirrhosis is an extreme version of that, where one gets a lot of collagen fibers and things that are involved in wound healing to try and repair things. It also, by mechanisms we still don't understand, leads to a much elevated risk of getting liver cancer. Both cirrhosis and generation of cancer have varying time course from a few years, something called fulminant hepatitis, it's fairly rare, The typical time course till you get cirrhosis or cancer can be greater than 30 years. So there's large, many people have this disease and never know. They're just very tired about it. And others notice it very, very idly. In the US, there's about 4 million people that are infected. And worldwide, it's about 170 million. And as I said, as I'll tell you the story about, it's the first chronic illness that can be cured. There's vaccines in trials now, or a vaccine's in trial, but there's no vaccine available yet. People would like to have a vaccine, because even though you can cure it, this virus spreads the same way as HIV does. It spreads by exchange of bodily fluids, by blood transfusion. Unfortunately, a lot of people are injecting drug users. They come up with hepatitis C, and they reinfect themselves even if they take these drug therapies. So that's still a major problem. I got involved in this in the late 1990s, and I'll show you a little bit of the history, but prior to May 2010, there were only two drugs used to treat this. In fact, starting in 1986, the drug that was first identified as having any effect on hepatitis C was type 1 interferon, called interferon alpha. It's a natural product. We all make it in response to viral infections. It was called interferon because it somehow interfered with the ability of viruses to infect cells. Later, it was discovered that a nucleoside analog called ribavirin had some synergy with it, and so one started getting some combination therapy. I won't have time to talk about ribavirin, but its mechanism of action is controversial, but I and many other people think it acts as a mutagen. It gets integrated into the growing RNA strands. Since it's a nucleoside analog, it doesn't have a complementary base. And in polio, it's actually been shown to act as a mutagen and accelerate the generation of deleterious mutations. Right now, there are a number of small molecule inhibitors, and I'll talk a little bit about those because this is how cures come about, involving an HCV polymerase inhibitor, a protease inhibitor, and a molecule called non-structural protein 5A, which when we started working, its mechanisms of action were not known, but it's not an enzymatic target. As I said, I first got involved in viruses by looking at HIV. And what was interesting about HIV and interesting about hepatitis C as chronic illnesses, if one looks in the blood of people who are infected with these viruses, one finds on the time scales of days, weeks, or months that the viral levels are relatively constant, basically flat up to the PCR era. In the case of HIV, when one treated them with antiviral drugs, what one saw on a fast time scale, and here this is a scale of days, is that the amount of virus would fall after a little bit of a lag exponentially and go down about one log or so after a week. And if one continued with therapy, it would then go into what we called a second phase. Turns out by doing modeling, and I won't go through the story here, this viral clearance is a very fast process. Which you can't see here, this is actually a bi-exponential. Viruses, our estimate there, were being cleared with a time scale of about a quarter of a day, every 6 hours. This phase we interpreted as the loss of the cells that were producing the majority of virus. And this second phase here we thought was a very minor population that was producing some virus, but these cells are much longer lived. And if one extrapolated back, you could see they produced just a few percent of the virus. This was actually revolutionary in HIV because at the time we started, everybody thought HIV takes 10 years to infect and cause AIDS, and it was a very, very slow virus. And what this is showing is that it was very fast, and there was a lot of fast dynamics, and that if one could inhibit the virus, you could get these very rapid loss of the cells that were infected and the loss of the free virus, and it led to the generation of combination therapy. And there were really three seminal papers that defined all of these early dynamics, very simple mathematics, which has gotten into all sorts of textbooks. And this is a review of the mathematics, and this is a little bit more of a biological review, if anyone's interested. But we're going to use some of the same ideas for hepatitis C. So this is just what I was telling you before. When these drugs were first tried, so interferon, as I said, is a natural product. It's tried basically for every viral infection. It sometimes has some Yeah, some use. When it was first tried, it gave rise to 6% sort of cure rate, and cure here means sustained virological response. It means you treat somebody, stop therapy. At that time, you'd wait a year or 6 months and see if the virus came back. And if it didn't, you said you had a sustained virological response, you were cured. So when I started working in this, we were doing people being treated with interferon for a year, three injections a week at a very low dose. Then ribavirin was introduced, and it helped a little bit more in getting a higher response, increasing the length. And then people started making a long-acting interferon, adding something called polyethylene glycol, or pegylating it, and in the U.S. could ultimately get up to something like a 50% response rate, and they were stuck there for decades until small molecules still started coming, and I'll tell you that story. The reason I wanted to tell you that is when we got involved, I'd done all of this stuff with David Ho on HIV. We take people who are infected and actually put them into hospital, got them to volunteer, put them on drugs, and we were sampling their blood every 2 hours to see fast dynamics, and every 6 hours, 12 hours. And I got a call from a head of gastroenterology at University of Illinois in Chicago, or somebody in his group, who said he'd seen all the HIV work and said, why don't we try the same thing for hepatitis C? It's another chronic illness. So he did exactly the same thing as David Ho did, because we told him the protocols. Put a bunch of people in a general clinical research center, kept them overnight, sampled them every couple hours. So this is on a time scale of days, but these things here are many, many points in the first day. And what you can see, depending upon the dose of interferon given, and these are averages over 8 patients, they would fall anywhere between a half a log and about 1.5 logs. Some patients fell 2 logs in the first day. And then it would go into a second phase. Now, what was interesting about this is for HIV, that first phase is on the time scale of weeks, or a week or more. So as you can see here, this is this first phase. It goes down a little over a log, sometimes 2, but something more like almost 10 days. And for HCV, what we're seeing is it's coming down in the first day. Really dramatic loss of hepatitis C. And then if you continue therapy, and this was given every day as opposed to 3 times a week, for reasons I won't get into, just to maintain the pressure, and you again see these nice second phases coming up. And the question was, is there any biology that we can learn from this and use it to adjust drug therapy? So we took a model, simple OD model ultimately, that we first developed for HIV, or now called really the standard model of viral infection. It's a cartoon. You have free virus particles called virions. They interact with cells susceptible to infection, which people in virology call target cells. Here they're going to be hepatocytes, the cells in the liver. And with some rate, if we're doing ordinary differential equations, or probability, if we do probabilistic models, they lead to an infected cell. In HCV, all the infected cells produce virus. I showed you, if you interfere somehow with this life cycle, virus can be cleared, because you saw on that last slide. Well, we know that there's immunopathology, so that the infected cells die at some loss rate, which is not understood. And there is some turnover of the hepatocytes. Healthy hepatocytes are thought to live for a very long period of time. They're terminally differentiated. They divide probably once every 6 months to 2 years. So very, very slow turnover in a healthy liver. So there's nothing here, but we will add a little bit to it. And so the question was, how can you explain the action of interferon? You know, why did it give rise to this two-phase decline? Well, when I started reading literature about interferon, it's called interferon because it blocks infection. And there was, in fact, one model by a particle physicist who hooked up with a hepatologist, and they modeled it this way. They said, well, you have interferon, it's going to block the infection process. That actually makes absolutely no sense, because I told you that the amount of virus that you measure in a person's blood before therapy is relatively constant, sitting there at some steady state. which means that there are infected cells, they're producing virus, and they're clearing, and these processes roughly balance for it to be in steady state. If I block new infections, to first order, it does nothing, because the infected cells are still there, and they're releasing virus. In the case of HIV, you can do that, and that's because the infected cells are short-lived. And short-lived in the case of HIV means that they live about a day while they're making virus. And that gives rise to this decline that goes on over the period of 7 days to a week. You can compute, if that was the mechanism here, that these infected cells have to survive on the order of 2 to 3 hours, which means your liver would just disappear if the infection caused your liver cells to die in 2 to 3 hours, because that many cells don't replicate that rapidly. So that's sort of a ridiculous explanation. Now, interferon does block infection, but that's not what you're seeing in the dynamics. And what we hypothesized, and was later shown to be true in cell culture models, is that interferon would have to affect cells that are already infected and somehow reduce the amount of virus they produce. It's also possible that they could increase the phagocytic process of loss, but in fact, if you analyze the dose response curve, you can show that it's going to be acting here, not here. So we said, well, it must act as a direct antiviral and may block infection, but its dominant effect would be to somehow prevent cells that are already infected from making virus. And we came up with this most trivial model. We defined an effectiveness of interferon in blocking production. We said it goes between 0 and 1, 1 being 100% effective. And I made a little model saying each infected cell produces virus at some rate P per cell. And it gets cleared with a first order rate constant C times the virus. And what the drug is doing is it's interfering with the production. So this is just sort of a rewrite of the cartoon, and I'll show you a little bit more. So you can do a simple analysis of these early kinetics, the first phase. So if I assume before therapy that you're in steady state, which I told you is what we observe, so then in zero here means that before therapy or in steady state, the production has to match the clearance, which is why these little zeros there. And if we also assume at short times that the number of infected cells is constant, it just stays at I0, because although we didn't know what the lifetime of an infected cell is, we knew a healthy cell lives, as I said, divides maybe once a year, and we didn't think infected cells were going to change on a very rapid time scale. So you can just take this differential equation now, replace pi by pi0 or cv0, you get a simple first-order differential equation. You know what the initial viral load is, you just measure that in the patient, and you solve it, and you get this sort of very, very simple expression that the viral load on after time t on therapy is the initial viral load times a decaying exponential, which is proportion goes down at the rate at which virus is cleared, and the effectiveness of therapy 1 minus epsilon. So long times, when e to the minus ct gets very, very small, the viral load should approach where it was initially, but reduced by a factor of 1 minus epsilon. And the slope of that decay will give you the clearance constant. So this equation can be fit to data. You can estimate the clearance rate. You can estimate the effectiveness. And because this works, and let me just show you what I just told you, you start off in steady state. You apply a drug. It turns out there's a little bit of a lag. And then it starts decaying with a slope C, and it stabilizes at this 1 minus epsilon. This is the patient data. And because this first phase occurs very rapidly on the order of the first day of therapy, the implication of this is you can measure how effective therapy is by the decline of the virus over the first day. So if epsilon were 0.9, if you were 90% effective, it would say you would go to 10% of where you were before. So one log drop meant a 90% effective drug. A two log drop or 99% effective drug would give rise to a two log. So you could basically, as a physician, they could read off how effective their drug was in blocking replication of the virus and production of new virus particles. From the clearance rate and measuring the viral load that you start with, you could predict how fast virus was being produced. This is per ml of fluid, should have per ml here, but then you multiply by the body water and you get a total body production, and then And I'll show you later when we start talking about drug resistance. You can then use that to try and predict what the effects of mutation will be and how many mutants you will generate per unit of time. Because every virus, every RNA is made by our error-prone RNA-dependent polymerase. So these production rates turn out to be close to 10 to the 12th per day. And as we later learned, that the point mutation rate from this in vivo is something like 2.5 times 10 to the minus fifth per base copied. So you generate all the single and double mutations that are possible, in fact, in a typical patient every single day, and that'll be important when we get to the drug resistance story. So this most trivial interpretation of a simple experiment really provided a huge amount of information. If you can, these are fits of two other patients with this orange curve. The green dotted line is what happens when we relax the assumption that the number of infected cells never changes. So you can go on and then go back to that. But for these three doses, what we discovered is interferon wasn't bad. At these three different doses, it was blocking 80% at the lowest dose and about 95% of production at the highest dose. The only problem is at this time, patients were being treated with 3 million units and only every other day. And that gave rise to an efficacy sort of more like 40 or 50%, which hardly does anything if you model it in this way. So this suggested that interferon had to be present at much higher doses and it be given much more frequently. The rest of the cartoon gives rise to these simple ODEs, which we use by mass action. So the next thing that we did is we said, well, over these 14 days, what if we just assume that the uninfected cells stay constant, but allow the infected cells to change? So again, if you assume that the target cells are constant at their steady state level, you can compute what they were, plug that in, the system becomes linear now, you can get an exact solution. The only interesting thing is once you do that, then it turns out you can estimate these two eigenvalues as the two slopes and estimate the parameters, C and delta, and it turns out that the clearance rate of virus is much faster than the death rate of cells. Virus particles are easier to eliminate than cells. And under those approximations, that the first eigenvalue is the clearance rate, which is what I told you before, and then the second eigenvalue is going to represent the death rate of infected cells. And to first order, it gets multiplied by the effectiveness of therapy. But if the therapy is 90% effective or so, it's by and large determined by the death rate. So again, you can just read things off these decay curves. So now we can also get our first estimate of how rapidly infected cells survive. Now what's remarkable is you see this fairly nice slope over 14 days. If one extrapolates this, just take, measure the slope and just extrapolate. At the time we were doing this, physicians had worked out a rule that if the viral load fell more than 2 logs or got below a certain level by 12 weeks, there was a high probability that they'd be cured. You could show that just by extrapolating this after the first 2 weeks, that we had a very good probability of being able to predict both positively and negative what the outcome of such treatment would be. And I'll show you a little later how we can do a much better job than that. But the most important thing in this, in terms of drug development, was recognizing that you could read off how effective a therapy was. And for interferon, it wasn't so important. But as the pharmaceutical industry tried to generate new compounds, at the time, before we did this, the way you'd evaluate any new compound, you'd put it into a patient, wait a year, stop therapy, and see if they rebounded or not. Clinical trials were at least a year. Here what we were saying is you could evaluate what goes on with drugs in a matter of days. That was adopted by the pharmaceutical industry, and the FDA bought into it. So this was the first protease inhibitor, experimental protease inhibitor, tried in chimpanzees and went into people. It was a 2-day clinical trial. The drug was just given for 48 hours, met these enormous declines, which were measured, and the drug was taken off and the virus rebounded. But they were doing exactly what we said, that they could measure the effectiveness of the drug by just watching these very, very early declines.
But do those dynamic work if you hit also other part of the cycle?
If you keep the...
If you hit, because here you mentioned that it was just blocking the release
infection.
Of the cell.
We'll get into that. So, yes and no. So it gives you information, but it's not accurate. So the other parts of the cycle will become important to get even more refined information, which became important in choosing drugs to go into these combos. But I just want to give you the flavor of this stuff. And in fact, because you could evaluate, partially because you could evaluate drugs so rapidly, in the early 2000s, not only was this developed, but a whole plethora of small molecule inhibitors started being developed and tested in this way. When we got in, they were still doing chimpanzee experiments, and the pharmaceutical companies discovered it's much more efficient and cheaper to try it in people. So they would do safety in small animals and then immediately go to people and do short-term trials. And by the end of the 2000s, there were over 70 compounds that were in various stages of clinical development, and many of them in early stage trials and some in late stage trials. And because you didn't have to go through this 1 year of clinical trial stuff, one can screen through enormous numbers of compounds. To go to longer term, which is obviously what you're interested in, you can't keep the target cells constant. They also change. So we had to extend our model by putting in proliferation. We know that hepatocytes can divide, even though it's small. And what's interesting is infected cells should be able to divide. The virus just sits in the cytoplasm. It's just RNA in the cytoplasm, so there's no reason that an infected cell wouldn't divide and generate the infected progeny. When we started modeling this, we were told that because it causes cancer, that you were guessing, some of our colleagues were guessing, the infected cells, in fact, might even divide more rapidly than the target cells. That turned out not to be the case. We got somebody, a guy named Stan Lemon, who's a very prominent molecular virologist, to actually do those experiments in cell culture and label up infected cells by CSFE and count divisions, and they divide much, much slower than target cells. So there must be some cost of generating the viral infection in there, but anyway, so.
So you have expression of virulence in the replication and the death rate for the infected?
Right, so all of these things are in the models now.
So D, delta is larger than D and...
So delta is larger than D. So these uninfected cells die very slowly. Delta is very large.
R1 is larger than, lower than R.
And RI for infected side is lower than R. And when you, so you can build these models with proliferation. And what's interesting, then you can solve them and they have two steady states, as in most of these sort of infection models, one where you cure the virus and some infected steady state, and there's a transcritical bifurcation. The only important thing in drug development is that just because there's a transcritical bifurcation, it says that there's some critical drug effectiveness that you have to be above in order to drive things to the origin. So it gave us a quantitative way of saying, you know, if you have drugs that are not very effective, they're not going to work. But it just quantified that. I wouldn't say that this was critical. It did allow us to explain other types of patterns that one saw. Unfortunately, everything wasn't quite biphasic. There were some very strange staircase-like things where you get these flat phases, and that these models explain by going into sort of a metastate where the loss of virus is being counterbalanced for some period of time by the proliferation of the infected cells. And it's not a stable state because we assumed that the growth is logistic. And as you start losing some of those infected cells, and the uninfected cells start replicating preferentially, and then you can no longer maintain the infected cells at a given level, and they get outcompeted and things go down. So it allowed us to at least say something more dynamically. It wasn't critical in cure. These types of models were tried by us on hundreds of patients. And then Roche, a bunch of modelers from Roche, looked at one of their registration trials for the pegylated form of interferon, in which they had data on, in fact, about 2,100 patients. And they fit them, sort of retrospective. They had all this data and they fit them and asked, would the model predict that they would, you know, go through what we call the cure boundary? So would they go to a point where they'd have less than one virus floating around in their extracellular body water? And in this calculation, they also asked, if you actually run the model, would you predict less than one infected cell at some point of time? In this case, it was one year of therapy. And when they did that, from when you could measure everything, they got a positive predictive value of 99.3% and a negative predictive value of 97.1%. So again, just looking at the early kinetics, where things were observable, these crazy models had enormous predictive power, saying they were capturing something about what's going on. Now, to get to your point, Olivier, so unlike HIV, there were no cell culture systems, and confirming the predicted estimates and their interpretation was difficult. It's a lot of sort of guessing. And now I'd like to tell you about the discrepancies that we started seeing as you went to other drugs. It was marvelous with interferon, and everything made a lot of sense. So new therapies were things we call direct-acting antivirals. So these are small molecules that would fit into the active site of protease, and those were, in fact, would be the first small molecule inhibitors that were invented. Then came polymerase inhibitors, and then something called NS5A inhibitors, which all they're extremely potent compared to interferon, no side effects, and work fantastically. So here's the first protease inhibitor that was put into clinical trials. It was made by a company called Vertex. Its not trade name, but its chemical name is called telaprevir. And this is data from a monotherapy trial, just some set of patients. And you can see it's, again, you see biphasic declines. So all looks just like interferon. However, if you summarize that and compare it to sort of the mean behavior we saw with interferon, well, first, it's much more potent, so it's more like a 3-log drug rather than a 1-log in terms of rapidly shutting off replication. But there were two other things that were bizarre. One, the slope here, as you can see, is slightly faster. So the clearance rate, as estimated for this drug, was about 12 per day, while for interferon, on average, it was 6 per day. And that made one sentence in the first report from this company about this with no comment on it. And then even more striking, at least in our predictions, when we tried to extrapolate out for the second phase, we found it was typically about 4 times greater than what we'd seen with interferon. So if clearance is just phagocytic cells eating things, we don't understand why the clearance would be faster. And if delta here is just immunopathology, the immune system killing cells, again, we don't understand why this changes. The other thing that we found that was really interesting and striking, for this drug, when we fit all of that data and looked at these second phase slopes, instead of just telling you what the mean was, what we discovered is that this second phase slope, or death rate, presumably death rate of infected cells, had this extremely strong correlation with the first phase decline, which you measure as a log base 10 of 1 minus epsilon, as predicted in the model. So what it's saying is the more effective the drug, so if it blocks, it's a 3-log drug, it means it blocks 99.9% of the replication, then the second phase would be much faster. Our interpretation of this, which is still not validated, but we think there's a lot of other evidence for this, is that because this is an RNA virus sitting replicating in the cytoplasm, if you effectively can shut down replication, then the endonucleases and exonucleases can attack this RNA and destroy it. And so the idea is that it's not the death of the cell you're seeing. You're just seeing loss of infected cells because they're losing all their RNA. It's not that the immune system is attacking it, is our current interpretation. So we think this is a reflection of the ability of these very strong inhibitors to lead to basically self-cure these cells. So at least that's... Now the other thing, even without that interpretation, the other thing
So you mean that you cure the cells themselves?
Yes, yes. Well, you stop the replication of RNA and the host cell just degrades the RNA. That's our interpretation. The other thing that we noticed, of course, is for interferon, as I said, delta is about 0.14 on average, and that's was our estimate, and Snook with their 2,100 patients came up with 0.139, so we think we're pretty good. So this is about 4 times faster, and what it also told us, if you then simulate the, well, Let me not tell you, I just told you all of this. You could then do some very simple clinical trial simulations and say, if I have this first and second phase, and the second phase can go down at this much more rapid rate, how long do I have to treat to hit these cure boundaries? And so this was a prediction that we made in 2008, I think, or maybe 10, maybe 10, that you should be able to reach less than one virus in something like 7 weeks of therapy in 95% of patients if you miss no doses, and maybe 9 weeks if you miss one out of six doses. At least telaprevir was being taken then at three pills a day every 8 hours. And that if you wanted to go to the last infected cell, it would add about 2 weeks. So it said very short therapy of order 8 to 12 weeks should be able to cure cells if there were no resistance. Now, this drug, and I'll show you in a few slides, generates resistance rather rapidly. So the idea was that you'd need combination therapy. And if the therapies were even more potent than the single drug, that would shorten things even more. At the time, therapy with interferon-based things were 24 to 48 weeks, and mostly at 48 weeks. So this led to the hope that these small molecule inhibitors could really shorten therapy. And one of my academic collaborators, a guy named John McCutchinson, who was at Duke, moved to one of the pharmaceutical companies, Gilead, and took over their hepatitis C program and took this seriously and actually ran very short-term clinical trials with their drugs based on these predictions. And he's told me it sped up the clinical development of this cure by 2 to 3 years. So they totally changed their development program. So anyway, I told you that in current theory, or the earlier theory, that the C was the slope of the first phase decline was, quote, the rate of viral clearance and should be independent of the drug used. And I mentioned that interferon was mostly around 6. We found a few patients where it was 9. This protease inhibitor, telaprevir, was 12. And then we saw the first report of an NS5A inhibitor by Bristol-Myers Squibb. It's now called desgladysphere. And we estimated from their data that the clearance rate was 23 per day. And this didn't take anything fancy. They published their first clinical trial where this drug went into patients. It was a single dose of the drug, given at three different concentrations. And at the largest concentration, you can read off of here, the drug viral load falls 3 logs, and it's about 8 hours. So. And then if you actually, we got the data from them, so they told us C was going to be greater than 20, and it turned out to be roughly 23 if you got the real data. So here's real data. Virus is really being cleared now with a half-life of 45 minutes. So all of our great modeling said it was going to be sort of order 6 hours, 3 hours, about 3 hours for this. So the question is, why did we get the biology wrong? What's wrong with our models? Well, I told you when we started that the way this virus is released is it comes in, it infects, RNA replicates, and then particles are assembled off the ER and finally released. So if I come in with a drug that blocks replication, say RNA replication here, well, what we had neglected is that it doesn't instantly shut off virus production. In fact, all the RNA that had already been synthesized and is sitting in the cell could still be assembled, and all the pre-assembled virus that was sitting there could still be extracted and released. So we said, we got to keep track of what's going on intracellularly to make sense and really estimate parameters properly. So we moved from that very simple sort of black box model to what I'll call an age-structured multi-scale model. And but a lot of fancy words to say that we considered infected cells to be little factories that produce HCV RNA, which are these little squiggles, and we call it capital R. So say they're being produced off of some template, and the amount of RNA that you have should increase with the time a cell's infected. If it's infected by a single virus, it brings in one RNA. This is replication of that RNA to make more of it. This is packaging it and excreting it from the cell, and this is degradation. And with time, presumably, the amount of RNA monotonically increase, or at least increase in some way. So we started building models where we put these processes in of a production of the RNA, degradation, and assembly secretion, and say drug therapy could act on any three of those processes. It's basically just doing a mass balance. And so, since we didn't know what drugs do, you could block, or you have less production if you somehow interfered with assembly secretion, or if you interfered with the actual production of the RNA, its replication off of its negative strand template, or if you increased the rate of degradation. So we were unbiased and said we should estimate what the perturbation of any of those parameters should be. That made the models a little bit more complicated because we had to keep track of the length of time a cell was infected, which we call the age of infection. So you get a PDE now for the infected cells. We had to write an equation for the RNA within a cell. That's its production. That's lost by packaging and secretion or degradation. We assumed that you were infected by a virus that brought in one RNA. The total amount of virus now was the RNA produced by and exported by cells of different age classes. And then you put in therapy of the way I just showed you in the diagram. And what's interesting is even though these are nonlinear equations and ODEs, if you recognize with these DAAs that the viral load's falling three orders of magnitude in 8 hours, you can make this nice assumption and say that after you give drug therapy, that the chance of having new infections decreases three orders of magnitude. So let's just set it equal to zero and call that a long time approximation. The drug is just decreasing the virus so rapidly. Then you can solve this analytically. And you get a very nice solution. And I won't go through it. It has three exponentials in it. And what we found by fitting that analytical solution with this NS5A inhibitor is, yes, you do see a very rapid clearance rate that's sort of 45-minute half-life, and then you go into a second phase. And this BMS data, the data only went out for about 48 hours and then rebounded. For interferon, there was a delay and then it came down. It turns out if you look at the analytical solution, the clearance rate is in the first couple of hours in here and you can't discern it at all. So what we were calling the clearance rate for this, we think had to do with the degradation of intracellular RNA. And this second phase, which is all of these terms, at least when you have a drug like BMS, which turns out is very, very effective in blocking secretion, and I'll show you, this term falls out, and the degradation, which is kappa mu, mu is normal degradation rate, kappa is its enhancement, and this is the death rate. You can lose RNA by losing the cell or having it cured. Turns out the loss rate of the RNA is much bigger than the death rate of the cell. So this phase is really the loss of intracellular RNA, which will come up in other things. And anyway, it explained this discrepancies and allowed us to fit things. What we found is for this BMS drug, you won't see this because it's the bottom of the slide, but we estimated that it had two modes of action. It was blocking replication, or from this source, which we called alpha, sort of 99.3%, and it also blocked secretion at 99.8%. So this was a non-enzyme. No one knew exactly what it did. It was detected in the drug screen, big pharmaceutical company screen for targets. Yes, Boris, before I go away.
Looking at the fits.
Yep.
So three exponential fits get to be pretty tricky and unstable,
yes.
Right? So
well, these would yes.
Do you have some other way of constraining the parameters that come out of these fits, or it just
yes.
doesn't matter what sort of the third one is effectively?
Well, So here we have a lot of problems with the third phase. I showed you only two phases in those fits. We think the third one is the death rate of infected cells, and we have a lot of problems with trying to estimate it with these new models. And that's because with these drugs, the viral loads go so low so rapidly that you get very little information. From some patients we do, so we now do population level fitting. So we simultaneously fit all the patients. Our latest way, which we've not published yet, but we're hoping to, is there's another marker that you can fit in addition to the viral load. So liver cells, when they're damaged or dying, release a set of liver enzymes, which is tested for clinically. So there are things called ALT and AST. If you ever look at your blood cell reports, they look for elevated level. These are alanine aminotransferases. So you can simultaneously get data on the ALT release, which is coming from dead cells. And so by simultaneously fitting them, we get further information about the death rate, which is the third phase. And I can, if you're interested, we can talk about that later. I have some nice stuff in manuscript form, but we haven't published that. But you're absolutely right. Just using viral load data, it's very hard to pull out three phases. But we do get a very strong signal, even on the first two, about the effectiveness of the drug. So
the drug is affecting the two different parts?
Totally different. So some having to do with the assembly secretion of virus particles, and the other, its replication.
Is there a biological explanation for this?
Well, the protein has multiple domains, and it's possible that the same thing. When we did it for interferon, we only saw basically one function. It was doing the replication was 98% for this highest dose. And for secretion, it was sort of in the noise, 0.41, so it wasn't doing very much. We did it for telaprevir, and we also got sort of two effects for the protease inhibitor, with a much smaller effect on secretion, but something that was above the noise level. We then tested this stuff in vitro. So you can ask, is this totally crazy or not? So here's an experiment that was done with the BMS drug, which we predicted does both. And it's being compared to a polymerase inhibitor, which, as far as we know, only blocks replication. What's shown here is you give the drug at time zero to an in vitro system, and they're measuring the loss of intracellular RNA in this culture system. So again, if you stop the replication, the RNA starts degrading. And the doses of the two compounds were chosen, so you got roughly the same decay kinetics intracellularly. And then if you look extracellularly, for the polymerase inhibitor, basically nothing happens for the first 8 hours, and then you start losing stuff in the extracellular media, basically reflecting what went on intracellularly. If you have less intracellular RNA, you package less and secrete less. And what was interesting is for the BMS, the NS5A inhibitor, by 6 hours, the amount in the extracellular medium was down a log, and as you can see, it dramatically falls. So it was not a reflection of what goes on intracellularly. This was done by Susan Uprichard, a colleague of ours at the University of Illinois, and then using a different in vitro system. This has been verified by another group at North Carolina State, showing that the NS5A inhibitors actually do both. And they also showed in vitro that the protease inhibitors actually can affect both secretion and assembly of these viruses. So these drugs are, you can't believe what they are by their names. And then this becomes very important if you want to try and combine drugs and get sort of the most bang for your buck. So these NS5A inhibitors are fantastic. So this was a, let me just jump and just say that based on all of this work and trying to quantify everything, it seemed clear that what you want to do in making a drug combination, you'd love to use these NS5A inhibitors. Because they are acting in two ways. They give rise to this very, very rapid clearance of virus, which is useful. You like to use a protease inhibitor if we're right that they can enhance the cure of cells. So they're the only drug that we saw that gives rise to this very rapid increase in delta. Most of these other drugs had mild, either no increase in delta above interferon or just a mild increase. And then the third component that we suggested is putting in a polymerase inhibitor. And that's because Gilead developed the most successful polymerase inhibitor ever seen so far. And this is this drug called sofosbuvir. If those of you who were reading about the high cost of hepatitis C, this is the drug that's $1,000 a pill when it was first introduced. It's an extremely effective polymerase inhibitor, but it has the property that when in vitro and in animal models, the only time resistance was seen with major resistance pathway was a point mutation, S182T, which really crippled the fitness of the polymerase. So the polymerase effectiveness fell something like 99% or so, at least in these in vitro systems. And when it was put into clinical trials, they never saw a polymerase resistant come up, you know, clinically in something like the first 5,000 patients that were treated. Later, they have seen some resistance coming up as it's being used worldwide, but it's extremely difficult to get resistance to it. So here is a pilot study that I was just involved with in 2016.
Do we know why it's so difficult to get resistance?
No, other than the one easy pathway cripples the polymerase. I don't know why it doesn't come up in other ways. There are some other mutations that have been seen, but they haven't been of any clinical relevance. So it's really quite an amazing drug. Gilead paid $11.3 billion for it, and it was a good bet. So this was just a pilot study looking at these combinations with a group of Chinese collaborators of mine, in which they asked whether or not you could shorten therapy. So there had been some work showing you can go down to 6 weeks, and they wanted to be very bold and see whether you can go to 3 weeks. So here's a set of patients. Chinese patients turn out genetically to have are easier to treat than Americans. We don't fully understand that. But these patients were chosen. They had to fall to less than 500 copies before 2 days, and if they did, they were just treated for 3 weeks. There were 18. Let me just finish. There were six patients in each of these groups. These are means, and all of them had the sustained virological response. They were taken off after 3 weeks of therapy and none rebound. They were all cured.
Could you repeat what you said just before you went into the data? I didn't catch what you said about the difference in treatment between the Chinese patients and American patients.
So they're easier to treat. So So HCV has different genotypes worldwide. So they're something called genotype 1B. In the U.S., it's mostly genotype 1A, and for reasons not fully understood, at least starting with interferon, treating genotype 1B is easier than 1A. The other thing that was discovered is that there were racial differences. So in the U.S., it was very difficult to treat Black Americans, African Americans, and that was finally worked out to correspond to a polymorphism in a particular allele.
Of the virus. So when you say difficult to treat or easy to treat, you mean the relative response?
The other one was a host factor. No, it was in a gene or promoter to something called IL-28B receptor.
So there's an allele that's more prevalent in the Chinese population than the American population.
That's right. So again, based on interferon, where there's decades of data, turns out that if you have the favorable allele, they would be able to get response rates in the 80% to interferon-based therapies, while the U.S. is more like 50%.
But it's not known how those genetic correlations
work for these drugs. That's right.
I see.
It's not. But somehow, since interferon is a natural product and we make it in host defense, there's a suggestion that if we have a favorable allele, maybe we're better. those people who have it are making a better host defense against the virus.
I see.
But anyway, at least that's what the clinicians say. These are much easier to treat patients, so maybe it's not so surprising that you can treat them in 3 weeks. This is being repeated now in much larger clinical trials in Asia. Asians, I think something like 87% of them have this favorable host allele as a population.
You mean from mainland China?
Yes. Also in Taiwan, and I mean, it's not, you know, that whole region, it's not countrywide. So anyway, this is just showing the first 48 hours. This is the 21 days, and these patients have all been cured. Now, one of the things that my colleague Jeremy and I are working on, and others, at least when we fit our models to this, the extent that we can, they don't get anywhere near this cure boundary of going below one virus particle, because this is per ml. So this is one virus per ml, not one virus per body. So we're trying to understand now why they don't rebound when you come off drug if these predictions are right. We think that the drugs may also be causing the virus to, that's being produced under these drugs, to accumulate either some mutations in them that are deleterious or that they're not being assembled correctly. So that the one hypothesis is that what remains is non-infectious, you're seeing in terms of RNA, but that's total speculation. So anyway, in general now, drugs of these triple combinations, and sometimes it's double combinations can also be used, are standardly curing somewhere between 95 and 97% of patients, at least in clinical trials. It's usually not quite as good in practice because patients don't always take all their drugs, but they are approaching over 90% cure rates. And there are these types of combinations that I just showed you. So it's pretty obvious that we now have attained sort of the first cure. So what about drug resistance? So I told you that telaprevir was the first protease inhibitor. We thought it leads to these great second phases and predicted what goes on. Well, if you look at the early monotherapy trials, here's one with just four patients who were put on protease inhibitor monotherapy for 14 days. This is just a bar chart. The purple is wild type virus, which in this case just means no known protease inhibitor resistance. And these colors, green, red, yellow, are different mutations that are known to occur. The orange is a double mutation, and the dark red is a double mutation. But the point is, this is day two. For those of you who can see it, there's a little bit of green. There's something going on here. By day two, if you look at these four patients, between 5 and 20% of the clones that were analyzed showed a drug-resistant mutation by day two. And then by day 14, essentially, all of the virus is drug-resistant. I think one of them still had a little bit of wild type. But if you look at these colored bars, they're essentially, by day 14, you're close to 100% drug resistance. And this was, I think, something like 60-some-odd clones at each time point that was being done by, this was done by the company. So very, very rapid drug resistance. So I was amazed that by day two, you'd have...
But isn't it faster than the dynamics you expected for the turnover of the viruses?
Yes, a little bit. So that's one of the things we'll come to. So one, we think what's going on is that these all pre-exist that are coming up very rapidly. And this is basically the calculation that I told you before. You can just do a simple binomial or Poisson approximation. You can ask if you have a genome, I guess this full genome here of, say, 10,000 bases, and then you ask what's the probability of having one base change, two or three, based on this point mutation rate. And here we're using 10 of the 5 per base because we hadn't had the in vivo measurement yet. From our kinetics of clearance rates, we're predicting that you generate about 10 to the 12 virus particles per day. Each one of them has to be produced by this error-prone polymerase with that error rate. So you would expect for single point mutations that you'd make 9 times 10 to the 10th of them a day. With a genome of 10,000, there's only 3 times 10 to the 4th possible single substitutions that you can make. So you're making every possible base substitution on average here, you know, 6 million times a day? So 3 million times a day. And if you do it for the doubles, you're scanning every double about 10 times a day. And it's only when you get to the triples that you're looking at a very small percentage. So we think both these singles and doubles, the singles definitely would pre-exist, the doubles most likely in most patients would pre-exist. They're also being cleared, which isn't being, this is just generation, but if they have a lifespan of order of 45 minutes to an hour, there's a good chance that when you take the drug or right after it, they would come up.
But in the previous slide, where the frequency was like...
5 to 20% at day two.
And they've lost 2 logs, or how many logs have they lost?
Yeah, you'll see the fits in a few minutes. But yeah, they lose 2 to 3 logs, closer to 3 logs usually in the first day.
They're 10 to the minus 4 or 5 in the initial population.
Yeah, something like that. Yep. So it came up, you know, this very trivial 2-strain model. We just lumped all the mutants together and called them a resistant population and drug sensitive. And just had 2 types of infected cells. You can put all the mutations in, proliferation, because that becomes important for the target cells. We didn't. We did try proliferation of the infected cells also. There was only one patient that was important. First thing we looked at is just keeping T constant in a very short-term simulation of what goes on to just see if you can get these frequencies. And So these were two of the mutations that came up that had been characterized in vitro. One was what we call, was called 3.5-fold resistant, which meant the EC50 was increased 3.5-fold, and there was another one that was 466-fold in vitro. And so we just simulated what would happen then to them. And as you can see, their frequencies can become enormous within a few days. And this would be the decay of the wild type virus, which by day one, as you can see, is going down about 3 logs. And what it's doing is it's basically uncovering the drug-resistant virus, which was before was at an extremely low frequency. And now, because the wild type is going down so rapidly, and for the one that was 466-fold, it hardly goes down at all. When we let the target cells vary, not only do they, then they start increasing. Usually after a day or so. So the resistant virus, I just showed you the first day or two where nothing much was happening, but if you do the full dynamics of it, the resistant comes up, the wild type goes down, and you're basically uncovering a pre-existing resistant mutation, is our explanation. Now, what was difficult about this is to make sense of it. We needed this very high loss of target cells to give, quote, replication space. So and we needed fast proliferation. So this is proliferation of uninfected cells, about 2 per day. That means every 12 hours the cells have to be dividing, and they're being lost also at a fairly high rate, which we didn't think was necessarily correct. So it drove us into the last part of this, and that's to think about how do these viruses come back very rapidly? How do you get such, you know, get up to 100% drug resistance? So this model was based on the loss of infected cells and their replacement by new targets generated by proliferation. But there are other possibilities. I mean, I told you that we hypothesized that you should be able to get cure of infected cells. So that may be playing a role here, that instead of being killing them and replacing them by proliferation, they may just be cured. There's also the possibility of superinfection, that resistant virus can infect cells already infected and cause them to produce resistant virus. That's not been predominant. You don't see recombinants. I mean, there's been a few isolated, but they're very, very rare in hepatitis C. And there had been some early in vitro experiments using colored viruses, viruses carrying green and red fluorescent proteins, and asking if you get infected cells carrying both colors. And what they showed is, yes, you can get dual colored cells if you mix the two viruses initially, but if you allow one virus to have about a day head start, that the possibility of getting superinfection successfully is about 4%, 3% of the cells being dually infected. So it looked like one cell establishes itself for one virus establishes itself. We've been involved with some other experiments with Charlie Rice's group at Rockefeller, where they're treating with these drugs, and that's no longer the case. We think there's evidence now that if you sort of can wipe out one population by drug, that you can invade the cells. So we think superinfection may be important. And then there, if a cell can come in, then you can have intracellular competition and take over. And let me show you why all that's important in this last set of data, where we have a lot of sequencing data. So one last experiment that maybe some population geneticists would like to see. So this is another phase one trial of a second generation protease inhibitor, this one by Merck. And we'll just call it Merck 5172. It's a small molecule shown here, which sits in the active site of the protease. It was designed to be able to handle some of the resistance mutations seen by the earlier protease inhibitors. So this is just, it has pangenotypic, means it's good against the major circulating forms. Let me not get into it. So this was the trial that they set up. They gave the drug for 7 days, and then they did follow-up for another 7 weeks, roughly to day 56. It's not quite precise as you see the data. And they sampled them and did population sequencing to see what the possibility of generating resistance was. And they saw some, but they weren't too worried about it. And we'll come back to the resistance. So this is the general dynamics of it. So you give the drug at day zero, it falls 3 to 4 logs in the first 1 to 2 days, and it goes into this classic second phase. And it's fairly insensitive to the dose. Then drug is stopped, and it's interesting, the pharmacokinetics of the drug are such that it doesn't wash out instantly, but around day 14, 15, it starts coming back, and then it comes back with a bang up to baseline. So there's this other window. So my colleague, Gerard Shaw, who's a colleague from HIV World, decided to get involved in HCV. And one of his technologies that his lab does is single genome amplification and sequencing. So he got samples from 8 of the subjects in this study. And at the various points in here where there are circles, which you probably can't see, did single genome amplification and sequencing. And I'm going to focus on just patient one, because it's the one patient that we have a very early sample, as it's still one of the two patients we have a very early sample. And it's a very dramatic evolution going on in that patient. Control patients, not given the protease inhibitor, they were sequenced, and I'll show you roughly what they look like. So let's just look at patient one, and if someone's interested, I can show you everything. We have all the sequences. So this is just before they were given the drug. This individual had a viral load of 2.6 million. Well, these are called international units. Think of them as copies. They're sort of of order 1 to 2 copies, depending upon the assay that they use of RNA per ml. These are quarter genomes, so he sequenced the first 2,500 bases, which incorporates the protease. These are called highlighter plots, so any place you see a consensus is just generated, placed on the top, and every place there's a colored tick mark, it's a base substitution from the consensus. Important thing to note is that every sequence is different, so there's no repeats of any particular sequence. It shows sort of typical diversity for a chronically infected patient of average of about 1.1 to 1.2% for mean and median. And there's no known drug resistance mutation in any of these sequences. So that's where we're going to start from. That's sort of a typical chronically infected patients. So this patient, his viral load went down below 1,000 copies while he was on therapy. And then when he taken off therapy 7 days later, the viral load started coming back up and hit 1,270, which and my colleague says it's very hard for him to sequence, but it's less than 1,000. So this is the first point they sequenced at. Now, what's remarkable here is he did 111 sequences. Every single sequence has a known protease resistance mutation. And these are listed here. The A156s are very common, and they come up, they're in red, and they come up on lots of different backbones. They're all over the place, things in red, you probably can't read them. And then there's a few double mutations, this Y56, D168, that was present in 2 of the 116. And then there were these ones that are R155W, A155G, which don't worry about, it's just a double mutant that came up. But what's amazing is if you look at all of these sequences are on the tree, these turn out all to be identical, and then you have 4 sequences at the bottom that have single point mutations. And this is about close to 40% of the sequences are identical over the first 2,500 bases. So it's arguing that somewhere after the drug was taken away, that presumably one virus or one infected cell producing virus survived and then colonized something like a third of the liver that's producing virus. So very, very fast takeover of the population. What's even more amazing is what if we go look goes on in time. So this is at day 27, the viral load's already back up to roughly where it was. So this is not constant population size, the population geneticists. It went from 1,200 to increased by a factor of 1,000. This orange double mutation, which was present in about 40% of the sequences before, is now present in about 5 sequences out of, again, 111. And the blue sequences, in which there were 2 in the previous time point, now are about 60% of the sequences. Now, what's remarkable is the drug presumably is gone. The virus is, growing like gangbusters. So the drug pressure is pretty much absent. And yet you've selected for a new drug-resistant double mutant. And in fact, all 111 sequences all are carrying protease inhibitor-resistant mutations. So we've had some sort of clonal competition turnover on a fairly rapid time scale.
But does it mean that you wiped out their sensitive somehow?
No, because I'll show you on the next time point, they start coming back. So here on day 56, we finally get four wild-type sequences, or four sequences that don't contain a known drug resistance mutation at the very top. They're black. But anyway, you can't see them very well. And my phylogenetic colleagues who've analyzed those tell me that they're closer to the baseline sequences than to a revertant of any of these mutants that could come up. So we think that they survive.
The drug still persists?
No,
basically,
no, but the drug is gone.
Yeah, you don't eat it any longer, but it doesn't even stay around.
Doesn't stay around. Merck claims it has a very short half-life. Doesn't stay around. And the fact that the virus has been able to go from less than 1,000 copies up to more than 1,000,000 and sort of replicating like it did in the absence of the drug. So the drug pressure should be totally gone. And yet we have these enormous clonal expansions. I mean, look at this green double mutant that comes up in the last time. This one was also present at the last time point, but it was let me go in the wrong direction. So there were a few sequences of this type. There may be 8-10% of them were these green ones, but now those two different clades take over, and again, they're all identical up to a few point mutations.
So is there a possibility that the viruses are being basically released in loads or something like this? That some of them are more, not being, and then you have a certain type suddenly being boosted?
No one's seen that. So this has been the puzzle. It's a combination of, it's clonal competition in some way, but it's, other than the last time point, the population size has been changing. It's a changing population. And it's in a system. What really perplexes me is that, in a viral infection of this sort, when you're not treating it, there's very little that's restraining it. The idea is that basically every cell that can be infected will become infected. Now, there are some intracellular defenses, this interferon type. So typically, it's not 100% of liver cells are infected, but it can go between 10 and 80%. There weren't biopsies, so I don't know exactly what fraction of cells are infected in these patients. But a large fraction of the liver will be infected. Now, the drug comes in and somehow stops the replication of the resident virus. It may not cure them totally, especially with your 7 days. We don't know. And then you release the drug, and then we see these enormous expansions. So we've been trying to work out a model that combines viral dynamics and type I just showed you with some of the phylogenetics, so-called phylogenomics.
I guess it's going to be the next slide.
Show you a little bit, yeah. So my phylogenetic colleagues tell me that they think, based on sort of a minimal description of how mutations could have evolved, looking at all the sequences, that you started with a wild-type population, and these are from bootstrapping on these various phylogenetic trees, what the pathways of getting. So they think this double mutant was most likely already here and being just expressed from in that population. Same thing with the A56s were pre-existing. Some of the blue ones look like they may have come off the backbone of the A156s, and same thing that the yellow ones may come back. And these are estimates of some of the fitnesses that modeling came up with. I can give you a manuscript that has those details. I'm not really great to. But anyway, what we need to explain is with 7 days of treatment with this, this drug rapidly selects resistant strains. The other one I showed you, the other protease inhibitor we saw, even within 2 days, you can select resistant. And that there exists this rapid turnover of different mutant strains over the 56-day study period. And most of these turnover events are the result of expansions of a few resistant clones, and they, quote, need replication space. And I only showed you data for one, but in 4 out of 5, the resistant mutants remain as the dominant strains over this 56-day period. So it's a very long time till the wild type comes back, presumably. Unfortunately, they stopped sampling them after that, so we don't know. So I wanted just to remind you that we think there's cure given this relationship between delta and epsilon. So we came up with these other the models. Wait, I lost some slides. Hold on. I was hiding stuff to make this shorter. Let me show you the model. I don't want to shortchange everybody. Yeah, so we came up with this model that we are now is our working. So this is our current dynamic model that we're playing with. It's sort of the standard target cell model with source, death, and infection. That's what we used before. Then we added in this proliferation term, and we make that logistic. There's a little bit of change in logistic. We keep track of non-infected cells also because they take up space. And there's some cells in the liver that don't get infected by the virus. As I show you, it's not everybody, so that's what this is. Then we thought there must be cure, and it should be proportional to the effectiveness of the therapy. So this 1 minus epsilon, and if you become resistant, your effectiveness is lower. And so cure would take you from an infected state back up into a target, so you're now susceptible to infection. Then we also included a superinfection term, which is down here, but basically it's trying to argue that if the fitness of virus J, if J is fitter than I, that virus J can infect the cell type I and convert it to one of J or vice versa, which you have to read through all of this, but that's all it's doing. We don't, and all the dynamics are just in one coefficient. And then there's a fitness cost for resistance, which changes the proliferation rate. So there's a parameter R sub I that's so less than or equal to 1. And then we ask, can we fit this, and do we fit all the data that we have for all the various forms, and do we need to include proliferation, cure, superinfection, et cetera? And we also try and estimate the EC50 for all these major mutations. And the answer without showing, well, I should show you the, anybody want to see the fits? I guess those are, anyway, this will fit the actual pattern, not only of the viral loads, but of the frequency distributions of each of those four Culley variants quite well, and somehow that slide got hidden. And when we do model selection theory, ask, do we actually need to put in both cure and superinfection and proliferation? The answer is yes. So we need proliferation as just the baseline for when cells die, they have to be replaced, and that's very important. Cure only comes about, is only important in a short window when the drug is taken away. So it's taken away at day 7, as I showed you, it really doesn't do anything in terms of just, the viral load doesn't start coming back up to day 14, day 20. So there's this window between day 7 and 21 where there's probably still enough drug around to have cure being a potential mechanism. So the model says that in that intermediate period of time, it looks like you're curing cells. But after that, from day 21 to 56, the drug is gone. Cure plays no role because it's drug-induced cure. We've also tried putting in spontaneous cure. That doesn't help. And so we think it's superinfection that has to go on. Somehow these cells are now becoming susceptible to superinfection, and that then gives rise to it. And this is just a cartoon of how we can get the expansion. So in the original framework, which I presented, in which there are many other models for just, you know, two species or multiple species of viruses where they're drug resistant and drug susceptible, they've all been based on just proliferation of target cells and killing them and generating them. And the new features of this is that we think that there really has to be the cure of cells of some sort to open up the replication, quote, the replication space early on, and that later to explain those massive turnovers when the drug is gone, we think must involve superinfection. And as I said, we've been working with a molecular virology lab at Rockefeller where they're making reporter viruses and treating cells in vitro and trying to show that at least with some of these drugs and some reporter virus systems, by knocking out the wild type virus, the drug susceptible virus inside, those cells now take up and can successfully replicate invading viruses. There's one other experiment of that sort that's in literature already. Whether it occurs in patients, the model suggests it, but I don't know what other explanation one can have when you have, you know, such a large population of existing cells that are already infected by one predominant strain, how you could have takeover of, you know, like 70% of the liver in 2 weeks. without destroying your liver and making new cells. You look puzzled. Worse. So this is that's really the last scientific slide, other than some conclusions, which I'll show you. But so let me just show you the conclusions, and then we can discuss this. I can go back and show you the data again. So what I'm trying to show you is that models of within-host HCV can accurately represent measured changes in viral load during therapy, and we think that they can be used to measure key parameters. In HIV, when we did this, we had all sorts of lovely in vitro systems to test them. HCV doesn't grow, human isolate will not grow in culture to first approximation. The only animal model is a chimpanzee, and they're no longer used for research purposes in the U.S. So everything's by inference. It's a much harder disease, but at least we're trying. So I think we now understand these parameters, but we could be surprised again. Due to the rapid turnover of the virus, all single and double mutants are expected to produce each day, so pre-existing resistant variants are expected, and combination theories are needed. And so we predicted that, and that's where we're seeing success in patients and curing them now with these 2 and 3 drug therapies. When protease inhibitor monotherapy is used, resistant variants arise rapidly and can be a sizable fraction of the viral population after a few days. I showed you it was 5 to 20% in that telaprevir one, and can completely dominate the population after 1 to 2 weeks. And the same thing was true here at day 14 in that patient I showed you. Every sequence was resistant. Fraction of resistant viruses initially increases due to the loss of the wild type, which uncovers the pre-existing variants. But subsequently, we see this rapid expansion, and that requires replication space, the nature of which is under investigation. But we think it appears to involve the generation of new target cells by proliferation, cure. There's also the possibility of release from an antiviral state, which we didn't talk about, which is what interferon does. And we can talk about that later if anyone's interested. And we think superinfection is also important. And then in terms of collaborators, Avdon Neumann was an old postdoc of mine. He helped in the HIV work and was my first collaborator on HCV. And he had been at Bar-Ilan, and he's now working at a hospital in Charité in Berlin. Harald Dahari was another postdoc involved in this early work, has continued to collaborate on HCV, and he's now in Loyola. George Shaw from the University of Pennsylvania has done all the single genome sequencing, and I should say he's continuing to do that, and we now have single genome sequencing data of this sort with not as frequent sampling, but in primary infection patients, and that's also interesting, and that's some of the places where we were able to estimate the mutation rate. And then Rui Lieben and Ruan Ki, other collaborators. Juan has been was a postdoc at Los Alamos, is now in applied math at North Carolina State, sort of been leading this effort for the phylodynamics I told you about. Okay, so Boris, so what we were struggling with are these sequence changes that I was showing you, these extraordinary expansions, and try and find a way to explain how this virus is evolving so rapidly in the population turning over.
Well, so I just got confused about sort of modification that you have to introduce in the model, right?
So we
basically saying that it's the recovered cells, the cured cells that are
targets.
getting
the problem is
infected, but right. then the statement is that a very large fraction are actually cured.
Yes.
And
but then they get reinfected. They get reinfected. So at least what the model suggests. So if you look at I'm going the wrong direction. Sorry, I'm not good at this. So we're looking at this. We're looking at this patient. So the viral loads come down. This is the detection limit here, about 1,000. Drugs taken away, and they slowly come up. And this is where we do the first sequencing. It's at 1,200 copies as opposed to 1,000,000. Everything's drug resistant. We think here that because it's just starting to come up, there's probably still residual drug. And that cells, if we're right, and we're seeing a signature sort of cure, that if you actually measure these slopes, they're like the ones we saw for telaprevir. They were much higher than what we saw with interferon. So it would be consistent that this second phase with the protease inhibitors also has this ability to cure. So we think that the original baseline viruses are being cleared because the drug is so good at stopping their replication. The RNA is degrading. These cells have less RNA. Their quote replication complexes may have fallen apart, so the host factors may not be limiting, and a new virus can come in and infect. And then the viral levels come up to close to baseline, or over a million copies now per ml. At this point, the drug isn't constraining things, so we don't think cure can be playing a role anymore. And the next puzzle, is why do we see this population, by and large, totally turn over? The dominant sequences here, which were sort of like 50%, go to 5%, and some very minor sequences here become 70% of the population. So it can't be cure. It's unlikely that you're killing off all the cells that were priorly infected because there's just so much of your liver. So our hypothesis is that somehow you can have superinfection and intracellular competition so that if the virus is fitter, somehow it can take over intracellularly. And when we take out any of these processes in the model, we don't get as good fits to the fraction of resistant viruses of all different phenotypes. I mean, modeling the total population is easy, but it's when you try and model the populations of simultaneously the blue, yellow, green, and orange populations is where you need all of these things.
So my puzzle is that initially, I believe you said that there was no evidence of superinfection.
In vitro experiments, we just take a cell line and try and superinfect without drug. It was very difficult to superinfect. In fact, once infection was established, it was a very, very low rate of superinfection.
So
a couple of percent.
Is there some statement that these cured cells behave differently than fresh?
So the question is, why would we get superinfection up at the top, right? So that's.
You see that you have a much larger difference in fitness compared to when those people took two strains, because if 3-4%, but then you have like a 20% more replication, then if you integrate that over time, it can be super.
That's a very good point. I don't have a good answer. You know, it could be that these cells are still not, you know, in the original state. The other idea that we've had is it may have something to do with the interferon response. It's coming back and assisting in this, because the protease inhibitors restore innate immune responses, which are normally turned off by this virus. But I don't know. But I couldn't think of anything else other than letting the data tell us that.
Do in all 5 patients, does the wild type come back at 56?
I think in not in all of them.
Well, not all of them, but it might
start. Yeah,
it might come back if you.
Yeah, and there's one patient where it comes back earlier.
Yeah. And your model fits. Do they suggest that the variants that are successful later have sort of a lower resistance profile, but a lower fitness cost at the same time? That's what you'd suggest, right?
So we also think that there's compensatory mutations of these drug-resistant variants, you know, are fairly fit compared to the wild type, so it's hard for them to compete.
And then I have one.
And so, as I said, you know, this afternoon we could look at all the numbers. I didn't want to bore everybody.
The superinfection idea. Don't you get then sort of complementation?
So in vitro, trying to get it's been hard to get transcomplementation. So you can get it with mutants in its NS5A protein. And NS5A protein is expressed at extremely high levels in these infected cells, about 1 million copies is what the estimates are. These other proteins, like protease, are in fairly limiting copies, or the polymerase. And at least in vitro, people haven't been able to transcomplement.
So NS5A is the...
No, it's a non-structural protein that seems to play a role as part of replication machinery. does something in assembly, it's, right, it's, but people can film it, it moves around in the cell, so it's you can make it, put a fluorescent tag on it, and you can see it assembling and disassembling, it forms punctate areas, and so it's very dynamic. So it's not surprising to me that you can transcomplement with it. The other proteins seem to get involved in the replication machinery and stay put, and I think they build these complex machines with host proteins, and it's probably very hard in the absence of drugs, which may sort of start breaking things up, to do something, my hypothesis. Yes?
You say that now you can treat 95% of the people.
Successfully.
What about those 5%? Are they having resistant viruses, or?
Some of them have resistant virus.
So there's a worry that they may spread around, or there's?
There is a little bit of worry about that, but there are a number of different drug combinations now, just like with HIV. They're trying to deal with that. And so new drugs have been developed that can handle things that were resistant to the earlier drugs.
To another three therapies.
Yeah. So that's what we think is happening.
So you think it's done? It's no more towards working on HCV, or?
At least for therapy is going to be very hard. I mean, a number of drug, in fact, the majority of drug companies that were, you know, developing these drugs have dropped out. So there's just a few drug companies now that are making drugs, and they're very successful. There's essentially no new drug development. So. And I know some researchers are worried about that, that it's been so successful that if we start getting resistance, somebody's going to have to go get their program back up together again. Like Bristol-Myers Squibb, which did this great NS5A inhibitor, disbanded their virology department. I mean, they made this drug, it's great. Now they're working on cancer, and they fired everybody doing virology. AbbVie is marketing some new drugs, and I spoke with one of their medicinal chemists, and he told me they stopped doing chemistry and looking for new discoveries about 8 years ago, and these other successful drugs are out there. They just carried along everything they discovered, you know, to the rest of the pipeline, and then are getting out of the business of getting new HCV drugs. And these companies are all going into, many of them are moving to cancer immunotherapy with their investments, or hepatitis B. So hepatitis B is a DNA virus. Affects about 300 million people. It's chronic. Drug therapy, if you give it, is for life right now. It's not terribly effective. Anyway, if people want to discuss this more, here in the lecture.